just got started last time, and we made it through verse 1. Hopefully we'll make it through the first 5 verses of this next chapter. Let me read them again, and we'll start right at the beginning of the chapter and read those first 5. Now, the point in what we are saying is this. We have such a high priest, one who is seated at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in heaven, a minister in the holy places, in the true tent that the Lord set up, not man. For every high priest is appointed to offer gifts and sacrifices. Thus, it is necessary for this priest also to have something to offer. Now, if he were on earth, he would not be a priest at all, since there are priests who offer gifts according to the law. They serve a copy and shadow of the heavenly things. For when Moses was about to erect the tent, he was instructed by God, saying, "See that you make everything according to the pattern that was shown to you on the mountain." All right, as we've covered over and over again, and it's important to remember the context for each one of the individual parts, this letter is directed toward those who are struggling in their faith in the Lord. They're struggling because of the pressure of persecution and the escape hatch that they believe is open to them is to escape back to an old covenant acknowledgement, meaning that if they would simply give up their public recognition of Jesus as the fulfillment of all that the old covenant points forward to, many of these Hebrews have become convinced that that will eliminate or at the minimum lessen the pressure of persecution that's being brought to bear on them only because of their allegiance to Christ. And so Paul is writing the letter to re-anchor their hearts to Christ, to the truth, to the new covenant. And he's doing so by doing a point-by-point comparison between Old Covenant and New Covenant to show the absolute superiority of the New Covenant to the Old. He's not arguing against the Old. He's not trying to say that the Old is bad. He's just trying to say that the Old is not as good as the New and in a significant and important way. And, of course, the focal point of the New Covenant is Christ as the fulfillment of all that the Old had pointed forward to. And in this section, what he's doing is specifically comparing high priests. So we've got on one side of the comparison, Aaron, who is the first of the high priests of the Old Testament, the Old Covenant, and he represents all of the Levitical high priests. And on the other side of the equation, you've got Christ Jesus, who is a new kind of high priest, a new order, not at all related directly to the Levitical high priest, but one that is now identified, as we've been studying, as a Melchizedek order of high priesthood. And what he's demonstrating, this isn't the first section where he's done this comparison between Old Covenant High Priest and New Covenant High Priest. What he's demonstrating is the superiority of the New Covenant High Priesthood. But in this section, in these first 5 verses, he does that first, as we saw in our last study in verse 1, by identifying the different postures between the Old and the New High Priests. The Old, what was his posture as he served? He was always and only standing. Whereas the posture of the New Covenant High Priest is a sitting posture. This is why in verse 1 he says, now the point in what we are saying is this. We have such a high priest, one who is seated at the right hand of the majesty in heaven. The reason for the difference in the postures and the reason for the spiritual significance and the reason why the distinction in their postures proves conclusively, if we only had this one comparison between Old Covenant and New Covenant, this alone would prove the vast superiority of the New Covenant to the Old. It's one of many advantageous features of the New Covenant, but the idea here, of course, is that Christ is sitting because the work of the high priest. And what is the work of the high priest? It's really ultimately all related to the people's ability to relate to God in this relationship of covenant that we call salvation. The work that Christ has done is finished. Therefore, he sat down, like at the end of a long day's work. He sits down because his work is done. Whereas the old covenant high priests, as long as they served in either the tabernacle or the temple, they were never, ever, ever allowed to sit down on the job. If they did, they would have immediately lost their standing, their qualification as a high priest, because they were constantly serving in such a standing position to show that the work was ongoing in the sense of being incomplete. And what work is that? The work, the primary work, it's not the exclusive and only work that the high priest did, but the primary work was sacrifice, offering sacrifice and bringing it into the Holy of Holies and to present it before the Ark of the Covenant. So the old covenant high priest was constantly standing. The new covenant high priest sits down. His work is finished. Now, the other feature that we drew out of verse 1 in terms of the significance of Christ sitting is not just that he's sitting. The Lord could have theoretically set it up like this. The old covenant high priest, who at the time of the writing of this letter, remember, is still functioning in the temple in Jerusalem. This is a letter, the Hebrews letter, written about 60 AD, as we've seen. So right at the moment this letter was being written, there was still an Aaronic Levitical high priest that was serving in a standing posture in that old covenant temple. And theoretically, we could have seen the Lord do something like this. Just establish some other location on planet Earth and have Christ go and sit down there to signify that the work is finished. He would, of course, had to do it after his resurrection, because the work being finished was accomplished on the cross. But he could have theoretically sat down somewhere on the surface of planet Earth to signify or to show that the work is finished, and the letter could have been emphasizing that point. But not just that he's sitting, but where, the location of his seat being amazing, unique, the singular most special location in all of existence, and that is he's seated on God's own throne. And we saw that the language of being seated at the right hand is not to be taken literally, but it's a it was a culturally relevant way of saying the place of greatest prominence next to the one who is in the supreme position. The one who is in supreme position, of course, is God the Father. And next to him, Christ has the most important position in God's purposes, in God's kingdom. And so he sits down at God's right hand. But literally, actually, what we see portrayed in Scripture and what we will see with our own eyes by the grace of God on the final day is that when he's seated at God's right hand, he's literally sitting directly on the throne of God. And he will be the one visible when we see that throne on that day. All right, so that's where we left off. Now let's continue to dig into the rest of these five verses. Now the point, verse 1, and what we are saying is this. We have such a high priest, one who is seated at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in heaven, a minister in the holy places. All right, so Jesus is now, this is now describing the high priesthood ministry and work of Jesus in his function as high priest. And here he's called a minister. And it's the word that simply means servant. A servant. And of course, anytime you use the word servant, It's always in relationship to a master. And in this case, while you and I refer to ourselves as servants of Jesus as our master, Jesus referred to himself as a servant to his master, who is his heavenly Father. So he's serving his heavenly Father, a minister in where? The holy, holy what? Places. Okay, now this is kind of a general term that could be somewhat open-ended if there wasn't a specific context that identified for us exactly what Paul must have been talking about. The holy places in the perspective of the Hebrew people was specifically focused on what we call at that time in history the temple. But the concept is related to more than a singular holy place. The concept has within its own context kind of a history behind it. And we see this history in this way, and we've studied this before. Let me get these on the board. There's a sequence or a series throughout the Old Testament of specially chosen holy places in which God chooses to meet with his people, to form covenant relationships with them, to express to them in the context of those holy places and his meeting with them in those places, the principles of a saving covenant relationship with him. And the history of that, those holy places, started all the way back in what we call the Garden of Eden, the first physical location that was the meeting place between God and man on planet Earth. And then that transitions a little bit later in world history to the Ark of Noah, in which the Lord ordained this one spot on planet Earth as being a saving spot, as being a place where he would meet with man, where he would bless man. Anything in that location was blessed and filled with God's blessing. Anything immediately outside of that location was subject to what we call the judgment of God, the curses of God, and of course that being in the circumstance of the flood. Then later in the journey through the wilderness, as the Lord redeemed his people from Egypt and led them through that 40-year wilderness journey to the promised land, he established for them, as they were camped around Mount Sinai, a new and special holy location, which became known as the tabernacle, which was also called the house of God. And then later, yet in history, under the time or during the time of King Solomon, that tabernacle was replaced by an even greater structure, a more permanent and solid structure, an unmoving structure. While the tabernacle was designed by the Lord to be moved from one location to another in order to serve the needs of the people and to properly portray the continuing relationship of the Lord to his people throughout their wilderness journey, once they reached the promised land, once they settled, once Jerusalem was established as the capital city, then the Lord gave to David a plan for the construction of that temple. He passed it on by God's instruction to his son Solomon, and the temple was built. And of course, what you have, if we were to continue this progression, you have a temple which was Solomon's, but it's still not Solomon's house. He's just the builder of it from an earthly standpoint. It's still identified as the house of the Lord or the house of God. And then was it Solomon's temple that was in existence in 60 AD when Paul is writing this letter to the Hebrews? No, Solomon's temple was actually destroyed, remember, in the invasion by the Babylonians and the conquest of Israel and the carrying away of the people of God into captivity because of a judgment that was necessary for the Lord to pour out even upon his own people. And that temple was destroyed, never to come back. But it was later replaced by a reconstructed restoration temple. That was the temple, of course, built during the times of Ezra, in the book of Ezra. And so we have a second temple. Which is, by the time of the writing of the book of Hebrews, is identified not with Ezra any longer, but it's identified with Herod, which is kind of a sad identification, Herod not being a godly man at all, but he was the one who had taken over the structure that was the temple that Ezra had built, and he renovated it, and he restored it to its former glory, and was right at the tail end, at the writing of this letter in 60 AD, of a decades-long reconstruction project of that second temple. So we have this progression: Garden of Eden, Ark of Noah, Tabernacle in the Wilderness, First Temple, Second Temple, and each one of these represents what is now identified in Hebrews 8:2 as the holy places. These are these special meeting places that God ordains between himself and his people, these spaces, these holy spaces that are unlike any other space on the face of planet Earth during the times that the Lord ordains for these spaces to function in that way. But having ordained them to function in that way, does that, and that's the question that's really being considered in the book of Hebrews, does that automatically mean that each one of these holy spaces, having originated from the Lord himself, having been given by the Lord for his special purpose, that they become permanent holy spaces throughout all of human history? By the time the Ark of Noah occurred, and of course that's in connection with the events of the flood, what happens during the time that the ark is functioning as this new structure? What happens is the flood wipes out the Garden of Eden. The Garden of Eden is outside the location of the ark of Noah. And as the floodwaters come, the floodwaters inundate the entire surface of planet Earth, and the Garden of Eden goes away. Does it ever come back after it goes away? Is there a second garden, third garden, fourth garden, fifth garden? There's only one garden and it's gone. Then the ark serves a special purpose. And even though you hear periodically some claims of Christian archaeologists, for the most part, discovering the ark in the mountains of Ararat in Turkey, you can trust me for this. The Ark of Noah is never going to be found. And there's a reason the Ark of Noah is never going to be found. It's the same reason that the Garden of Eden is never going to be found. It's the same reason that the Tabernacle in the Wilderness is never going to be found. It's the same reason that Solomon's Temple was never going to be found. And it's the same reason that the Second Temple, all we have left of it is what we've identified as the Wailing Wall, those few stones from the foundation layer that are still in place. Each one of these special structures serves a specific purpose of God, a similar purpose in each case, to reveal that this is where God meets with his people. This is where you experience salvation. But once God's done with that structure that served that purpose of the Lord for that era of history, that structure gets wiped out and replaced by a successive structure. So that here we are, 60 AD. And we're reading the book of Hebrews as it's just come hot off of the presses of Paul's pen. And he sent it to the Hebrew Christians. And they're reading about this second temple. At this point in history, for them, not just for us, the Garden of Eden was gone. The ark was gone. The tabernacle was gone. The first temple, Solomon's temple, is gone. And all that remains of all of these special structures, and it's still standing at the time of the writing of this letter, is the second temple. The temple built by Ezra and rehabilitated or renovated, we could say, by King Herod. What's the problem from the perspective of the Hebrews? From the perspective of those that are receiving this letter and are struggling under this weight of persecution, they're making the same mistake that each of the generations associated with these earlier structures tended to make, which was the presumption that since God had built this thing, since God had given us this thing, it must have a permanence in and of itself. And it could never go away because the Lord has given it, the Lord has done it, the Lord has worked with it, the Lord has filled it, in a sense, with his own presence. Why in the world would the Lord abandon it? And yet there's an important purpose for why the Lord abandons each prior house, each prior special location and special structure. And one of those purposes is God is displaying in this process a principle of progression. It's what theologians call progressive revelation. The idea that God chose not to unfold the fullness of his plan right from the beginning, but part by part, layer by layer, in a sense, chapter by chapter, the Lord is unfolding more and more of his purpose. But each of the generations associated with these structures tended to think this must be the fullness of what God can and will and is doing in the earth. Do you think, let me say it this way. Do you think Adam and Eve were thrilled about the idea of being evicted from the Garden of Eden, never to have access to that location ever again? They absolutely were not thrilled about it. As far as they were concerned, this is where God is. This is the place we meet with God. This is the place we experience the saving benefits of covenant relationship with God. They didn't want to leave it. Now, of course, Noah is in the ark. Now the floodwaters have receded. And as soon as the floodwaters recede, is Noah opening the door on the side of the ark? Just, I can't wait to get out there to normal life as I have previously enjoyed it prior to this flood experience. The Lord had to send Noah out of the ark. He was in no rush to leave that place of security and safety. And by now, after months in the ark, familiarity. So Adam and Eve are ejected from the garden. Noah is sent out of the ark. The Lord, of course, gives his people the tabernacle, and their entire life for generations of time, much longer than the Garden of Eden, much longer than the ark, for generations of time after the formation of the tabernacle, the people of God associate the presence and purpose of the Lord with this tabernacle structure. But there comes a moment in God's purpose where it has served its purpose, and it's actually now, at the time of its replacement, when Solomon's temple comes onto the scene, it's a counterproductive display, symbolically, of God's purpose, because it conveys a wilderness journey, not a settlement in the promised land concept. And so it must be replaced, but in order to replace it, what the Lord does is he gives a blueprint, a plan for the construction of a new replacement structure, and then we don't hear anything more about the tabernacle after that. We don't know if it was intentionally destroyed or if it just fell into disrepair, but the tabernacle goes away, and the Lord no longer identifies it as his dwelling place, as his house, and once the temple replaces it, the Lord no longer accepts any sacrifices to be offered there at the tabernacle. Prior to the finishing of the temple by Solomon, the tabernacle was the only place that a true Israelite could be saved, because it was the only place where acceptable sacrifices could be offered for atonement for their sins. But the day, the moment that the new temple under Solomon was finished in its construction and the first sacrifice is offered in the temple, no other sacrifice is any longer acceptable in the tabernacle. The tabernacle ends in God's purposing through that structure. Then, of course, the temple under Solomon is destroyed, and the generations to follow because of the rebellion and sin of the people in that Babylonian captivity. And for a 70-year period of time, there is no holy place. The Lord literally removes all holy places from the face of the earth in order to teach his people a lesson about the value of what they had so dishonored and disregarded. But then eventually, in his mercy and graciousness, he replaces it with a new temple under Ezra. And as soon as that structure begins to function as that new holy place, this is then the only place where God will meet with his people, and the only place where acceptable sacrifice can be offered unto the Lord in order to accomplish the atonement of the sins of the people. Now that leads us all up to 60 AD. Now, what's going on is that back in 30 AD, something significant occurred. It's more than one thing that occurred that was of significance in 30 AD, but we're going to take these as a singular great event. And what happened in 30 AD is, of course, the cross of Jesus, the resurrection, the ascension, and the enthronement of the Lord after his ascension in heaven. Now, at that point, we have two options in our consideration of what God is doing in history. And this is where the Hebrews are. They're stuck with a preliminary understanding of what the Lord has done. And yet their hearts, because of this pressure of persecution, has so wavered that they now, 30 years after Jesus died on the cross, rose again from the dead, ascended back to heaven and sat down as the enthroned new covenant high priest. 30 years after that great event, they are thinking they can retreat backwards in God's progressively revealed purpose. They can retreat back to a stone temple and to a Levitical high priest, and that they can find refuge in a place that God no longer treats and counts and considers his home or his meeting place or a saving place for his people. Why? Because just like he abandoned the garden, just like he abandoned the ark, just like he abandoned the tabernacle, just like he abandoned Solomon's temple, he's now already abandoned the temple built by Ezra and rehabilitated or renovated by King Herod. Now, why is it still standing if he's already abandoned it? We've talked before about how God has given his people this 40-year grace period. The 40-year grace period started the day Jesus died on the cross. And it extends, tacking 40 years onto 30, to 70 A.D. Why 70? We know and understand. This shouldn't be a mystery to you by now. 70 A.D., what's going to happen to this second temple? It's going to be destroyed. It's going to be wiped off the face of the earth, just like the first temple was, just like the tabernacle was, just like the ark was, just like the Garden of Eden was. And once it's wiped off, what the Lord is doing is he is graciously communicating through real world historic events that I've moved on. That old meeting place no longer functions in that way between you and me. I'm no longer filling that with my presence. I'm no longer identifying that as my house. I have moved on. So the only question that remains for us to get resolved is, moved on to what? We've got this progression. of all of these special meeting places fitting into this category of what Paul calls now in verse 2, the holy places. And we've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 of them here on in this list. But what has he moved on to? What is there beyond the second stone temple, the one that was standing at that time in history? Well, what he's moved on to is a new and greater structure, but it's new and greater not in a physical sense, and this is what was troubling so many people that were alive during that time in history, and they didn't fully grasp it, they didn't fully get it. He's moved on completely from a progression of one physical structure to another, to another, to another, to another, to a new and greater spiritual structure. And that new and greater spiritual structure is the final one. The idea is the Lord's been doing this movement from one structure to another through these various eras of world history, redemptive history, salvation history. But there was always a goal. There was always an end to the progression. And the point that Paul is making in this section is that God has reached that end point, that conclusion, that grand finale of his purpose. And the final structure is, of course, what we call the church, which is a structure not of physical stones, but as Peter describes it in his letter, living spiritual stones. Those living stones are people rather than physical structure stones. We are a spiritual structure made up of human beings, made up of souls that have been redeemed and saved. But in this section, the focus is not so much directly on the church on earth. In this section of five verses, the focus is on what the church itself represents. Now let me read verses 2 through 5 again with all of that buildup, with all of that background. Let's read verse 2. Jesus is being described in his new covenant high priesthood. And here he's described as a minister in the holy places, in the true tent that the Lord set up, not man. For every high priest is appointed to offer gifts and sacrifices. Thus it is necessary for this priest also to have something to offer. Now, if he were on earth, he would not be a priest at all, since there are priests who offer gifts according to the law. They serve a copy and shadow of the heavenly things. For when Moses was about to erect the tent, he was instructed by God, "See that you make everything according to the pattern that was shown you on the mountain." Now, there's three key focal points in these verses that I want to highlight. The first one is in verse 2, immediately after the phrase, speaking of Jesus as a minister in his new covenant high priesthood, a minister in the holy places. But the phrase is this, in he's ministering or he's serving the Lord's purpose, God the Father's purpose, in the true tent. All right, first of all, he uses the word tent, and that's not accidental. It's not coincidental. It's very purposeful. When he uses the word tent, talking about the ministry of the high priests, what would the people reading this letter think of? They would think of this structure right here in the middle of the progression. Now, I've added the Garden of Eden and the Ark, and it's not me just pulling stuff out of thin air to add those structures to this progression. These are true meeting places between God and his people, true saving places for their moments in history. But until we see the whole list connected to each other, it's somewhat vague and mysterious that the Garden of Eden and the Ark actually functioned in that way. It's not until we get to the tent that was given, the blueprints for the construction of the tabernacle in the wilderness that's given on Mount Sinai to Moses. It's not until we get to this point in the list, the progression, that it begins to become obvious that God is setting apart one specific structure to serve as a holy meeting place between himself and his people. So when Paul uses this term, tent, he is connecting what Jesus is doing to the tabernacle in the wilderness. But here, he is not saying, and I think you can follow this very easily, he's not saying that somehow Jesus went back in time and began to minister in the tabernacle that was actually physically in the wilderness. He's just referencing the concept of a special holy meeting place between God and his people that was first fully revealed in the tabernacle event, the tabernacle structure. But what's interesting about the phrasing that Paul uses here in this verse 2 is he calls it that Jesus is the minister of God in the true tent. Now that's just filled with implications. And it's a single word. It'd be easy to read past it and not give it its proper weight in terms of shaping our perspective. But for these people that Paul is writing to, it's like they don't dare read over this word and miss the big point that is being made in using it. All right, so if I say to you, the true church, what does that imply to you? And I'm not just talking about our fellowship as the true church. I'm talking about worldwide, there is such a thing as the true church. What am I implying? What am I meaning? I'm meaning that there are actually two churches worldwide, right? That's the implication. There's a true church and a false church. True usually is contrasted and compared with false, right? True church having the idea of those who are part of the true church are true followers of the Lord, truly born again, true disciples, truly saved. Whereas there are many who claim to follow the Lord, many who claim to be disciples but are not actually his followers. So when Paul says Jesus is a minister in the true tent, is he implying, because that's the first and natural perspective that would occur to our minds, is he implying that the other tent that's in view here is a false tent? And the answer is no, that's not the comparison he's making. Because what he's comparing here are two tents. All right, tent number one is the original one in terms of their familiarity. The original one is the tabernacle in the wilderness, going all the way back in history. But Paul's saying, what you didn't realize, and he's writing to the Hebrews that are struggling, wanting to go backwards, remember. So he references the starting point of this wrong perspective that's shaping their decision to release their hold on Jesus as the Messiah. He's saying, look, the tabernacle in the wilderness, that's real, and that was from God. But there's another tabernacle, another tent that you were not aware of, but you should be aware of. So at the moment that he's writing this, the tabernacle in the wilderness has gone away, but it's at least something clear and familiar in their memory and their perspective and their understanding. What's the second tent that he's talking about? He's comparing two tents, a true tent and another tent. He's talking about a heavenly tabernacle. A heavenly tent. He's not talking about the church on earth. The church on earth actually functions in the same way that the tabernacle in the wilderness function, in the same way that the garden function, in the same way that the ark function, in the same way that the temples under Solomon and Ezra function. That's how the church functions, as the representation of God's purpose, his saving purpose on earth. But now what Paul is wanting to broaden their heart's perspective to understand, and they have totally missed this point. And sadly, even in successive generations of Christian history, many true followers of the Lord miss this deeper point. And that is that God's purpose has never been limited to an earthly expression of salvation. And whatever is the structure on earth of where he most makes himself known at any particular time in history. God's purpose is bigger than that. God's purpose is broader than that. God's purpose is greater than that and always has been greater than that. The tabernacle in the wilderness was identified as that structure that was built by Moses and was moved from location to location. The heavenly tabernacle is referring to something somewhat mysterious. But when I say heavenly, I'm not just talking about a tabernacle on earth that has heavenly characteristics, because the original tabernacle of Moses was that. It was a tabernacle on earth with heavenly characteristics. We're talking about literally a tabernacle in heaven. A tent in heaven. Now, if you and I were to go to heaven right now, and the Lord's purpose, that's it. We each breathe our last breath here in this world. Our heart beats our last time. And we're instantly, because we're true believers in Christ Jesus, I hope, in the case of each one of us here, we instantly join the Lord in heaven. Would we see a physical tent set up in heaven, like with skins of animals, because that's how the original tabernacle was made, right? And with all of the other furnishings that make up the tabernacle in the wilderness. Would we see an identical model? You know, sometimes with good intentions, I have no problem with this, by the way, don't misunderstand me, but you'll see reconstructions in terms of best understanding of what it must have been like of the tabernacle in the wilderness. Just like I think there's just recently been a finished reconstruction of the Ark of Noah that you can now go and visit, which sounds pretty cool, and I'd like to go check it out myself. But would we see a reconstruction of the earthly tabernacle in heaven, kind of like set up as a permanent museum or maybe even still a functioning tabernacle in heaven? Would we see a tent like that in heaven? Are we on the same page? You're not going to see a tent in heaven. But Paul's just said that there is one, a true tent in heaven. But you're not going to see a tent in heaven. So what is he talking about? He's not talking about tent in a literal sense, but tent in the sense of what the tent in the wilderness represented, how it functioned as the focal point of God's redeeming, saving purpose. We will see that in heaven. Now, let's look at a passage in the book of Revelation that will help us with this, I think. It's just one single verse, and actually one single phrase. Revelation chapter 14. And I'm not going to take the time to fill in all the material in front of this verse and all the material after this verse. I just want to capture the implications of the verse itself. Revelation 14, verse 17. Revelation 14, 17. Then another angel came out of the temple in heaven. And he too had a sharp sickle. Another angel came out of the temple in heaven. All right. When we get to heaven, will we see a reconstructed exact duplicate of Solomon's temple in heaven? No. Because now we're going to struggle, because if that's the case, we're going to need to see a reconstruction of the Garden of Eden, the Ark of Noah, the Tabernacle in the Wilderness, the Temple of Solomon, and the Temple of Ezra. And then, of course, it's renovated under Herod, and we're going to need to see a model of that as well. If what each one of those structures represented has to be in some physical way exactly portrayed in its heavenly reality. And yet there's something here that we dare not miss. There is a temple in heaven. There is a tent in heaven, a tabernacle in heaven. There is, we could say it this way, a Garden of Eden in heaven. There's a tree of life in heaven. There's a river of water flowing from the throne of God in heaven. There's an ark of Noah in heaven. There's a tabernacle, a temple, and a temple in heaven. Each one of these structures, in what they conveyed, is actually fully functioning right now, and not right now only, but always has been, and throughout the duration of human history as we know it, continues to function, but in its heavenly fullness. There is a meeting place between God and man in heaven. There is a saving place between God and man in heaven. And when we get there, we will see it in its fullness. Now the question becomes, if we have an earthly tent, two tents, we have a... Let me get this list off the board here. So we have two tents. We have a earth tent, and we have a heaven tent. Which one did God make? He made this earth tent in a sense, but not directly, not immediately. He had Moses make it. He gave Moses a blueprint. He gave him a plan. He ordered him to make it exactly, as it says later in this section, according to the pattern that was shown to him on the mountain. But the hands that actually constructed it were the hands of Moses, not the hands of the Lord. Now, in terms of the heaven tent, who made that tent? Well, this section, let's go back to the Hebrew section, tells us very clearly and specifically. Verse 2, a minister in the holy place is in the true tent that the Lord set up, not man. The heaven tent is set up by the Lord. The earth tent was set up by man. Both represent the same concept, the same spiritual principles, the same meeting place between God and man concept, the same this is the only place and way you can be saved concept. Both are fully representing the same principles, but if push comes to shove, and it does at this moment in the writing of the book of Hebrews, if I said to you, okay, you can only have one, there's two tents. There's an earth tent and a heaven tent. But you can only have one, ultimately, at the end of the day. Which one do you choose? You better choose the heaven one. Why? Because the earth one goes away. The heaven one never goes away. Once the Lord sets it up, and he's already set it up, that's the idea of the passage here. It's not that when the earth one went away, the Lord just scrambled and put together a heaven one. So the question is, when did the Lord set up the heaven one? We don't know exactly, but the implication is he set it up way before the earth one was ever set up. And that's the implication of what Paul is drawing in this passage. He's saying, when he's saying the true tent, when he's saying made according to the pattern, he's saying that the pattern that was revealed to Moses was based upon something that God wasn't just making up on the fly at the moment that he met with Moses on the top of Mount Sinai. He gave him a pattern that was following
an already existing greater spiritual structure that existed already in heaven. So there's a true tent. We could say it this way, true garden, true ark, true tent, true temple, and that's all one single structure, which is a heavenly structure. And the Lord Himself set it up, and He set it up before human history even started. And all of these earthly representations, layer by layer, each structure which succeeds the previous one, adding a little bit more redemptive information to the pool of understanding of the covenant people of what God's great saving purpose in history really is. But each one representing this greater, truer structure. True not in the sense of the earthly ones are false, but true in the sense of the earthly ones are only what we would call, I think this is the best word to describe it, provisional. Provisional versus permanent. All right, so the earthly structures, each one of them in turn, was a provisional structure, serving a specific purpose for a specific period of time, but with a preordained endpoint to its functionality. Whereas through all of it, and underneath all of it, and behind the scenes in all of those earthly representations, there is a greater structure that's already in existence. A heavenly structure, a permanent structure. And how permanent? Eternal. An eternal structure. And of course, in that structure, there is a special role that only one can fill. So the tabernacle had one role, there were many roles in the tabernacle, but there was one role that rose in significance above all other roles. It's the role of the high priest. The temple, one role, greater than all other roles, the role of the high priest. And now Paul is saying what the Hebrews have missed is that only Christ can fulfill that role of the greater structure. And the Hebrews are retreating back to a provisional structure, and by doing so, they're in danger, at least, of disengaging from the permanent eternal structure and the role of the only one that can actually save them in an eternal sense by disconnecting from their acknowledgement and their trust and declaration of Jesus as that new covenant heavenly high priest. So he calls him a minister in the holy places, in the true tent that the Lord set up, not man. For every high priest is appointed to offer gifts and sacrifices, meaning that's the focal point of his ministry. Thus, it is necessary for this priest also to have something to offer. Now, he's going to in the next chapter, and we'll of course, camp in the next chapter of chapter 9 for some time in what it is that Christ in his Melchizedek high priest role, what he offered. But it's not for us a big mystery. We know what he offered is. He offered himself on the cross. He offered the ultimate sacrifice. And so he's not just here comparing in this verse the old covenant high priest with the new covenant high priest. He's also comparing the old covenant sacrifice and gift to the new covenant sacrifice and gift, demonstrating the vast superiority of the new covenant in every way. And then in verse 4, now, if he were on earth, and the focus here is still on Jesus, if he were on earth, at the point that Paul's writing this, he's not. He's seated on the throne of God in the in the heavenly places. If he were on earth, he would not be a priest at all. Why? Because only in those, in the earthly tent, the earth tent, which at this point is the temple in Jerusalem, only someone born, as we've talked many times, of the descent of Aaron and the descent of the tribe of Levi can actually enter into that structure and function and serve as a high priest in that structure. So if he were on earth, he would not be a priest at all, since there are priests, Levitical and Aaronic priests, who offer gifts according to the law. Then in verse 5, they serve a copy and shadow of the heavenly things. Okay, this is our next big focal point. I want to give it its due weight here. Wipe out all this information. Now he's talking about the service of the Levitical, Aaronic, earthly high priests in the temple in Jerusalem. What they're doing right at the moment Paul's writing this in 60 AD. And he's saying each one of them throughout history, starting from Aaron all the way up to this present time in history, they all served a copy and shadow. All right, the word copy is related to something, and shadow is related to something. So when you refer to having a copy of something that's valuable, by implication, there is an original that's in view. Like if you said, I own a really high quality copy of a Rembrandt painting. That could be valuable. A really high quality copy could be valuable. Could certainly look beautiful on your wall. It could function in a lot of ways that the original functioned. But if you were to set them side by side and have someone that knew what they were talking about and was able to properly evaluate the differing values of the copy and the original Rembrandt, you'd see that the copy pales in comparison to the original. The original has a unique value and a much greater significance than the copy can ever have. Now, what's interesting about this concept, and this goes along with what we've already established, is he's saying that the tabernacle, the temple on earth, they were always, from the beginning, even the very first day that they opened for business, you know, everything is pristine, everything is perfect, exactly made according to the pattern given by the Lord. From day one, they were only ever intended by the Lord to be copies. Neither was the original. So where is the original? The original was always in heaven. Always. The problem for the people that were given the tabernacle and given the temple is they didn't grasp the concept that there was an original that always overshadowed the copy. The copy only is useful as it points to an original. It's never meant to take on a unique value unto itself apart from its relationship to the original. If I said to you, I've got a copy of a Rembrandt, but there was no original, how valuable would my copy be? Probably not nearly as valuable. My copy only has value as it successfully portrays and relates to the original. So, the old covenant tabernacle and temple were never intended and meant by the Lord to be the focal point of his people in terms of their real saving connection to the Lord. They were only meant to point their hearts heavenward to a greater structure that always existed and always overshadowed the earthly ones. Now, shadow, of course, has its own special relationship. Shadow relates to what? Like copy relates to an original. What does shadow relate to? We could call it the substance. And form is good. Form is a good word. But form not just in as an empty form, but as a substantive form. All right, so we all understand how shadows work. Shadows are cast by a relationship to something that is substantive and solid, and shadows bear a relationship to that substance in terms of, as you look at a shadow, you can gain some perspective and understanding about the substance that's casting that shadow. But the shadow can never fully convey the fullness of the substance that it shadows. It can only point to it in a kind of provisional way, in a kind of in part way. It can never show the fullness of what is casting that shadow. And so when Paul says that those who are currently serving in the tabernacle in the temple, and this applies to all of the priests, all of the high priests from Aaron to this present time, they have every single one of them without a single exception only ever served the copy and shadow of something greater than the location of their highly significant service on earth. And that the original and the substance casting the shadow is a heavenly structure served by a heavenly high priest. And his point to them is, do you really, if you get this, if you see this, if you understand this, do you really want to disconnect, turn your back on the greater structure that is the original, the greater structure that is the substance, and the high priest who functions and serves in the original in heaven, where the actual substance of salvation is? Do you want to turn your back on that only to find your hope of salvation and your refuge in the copy and the shadow, which, by the way, at this point in history, were about to go away, never to return? And of course, because those people struggling under this intense persecution didn't really grasp this concept apart from the writing of this letter, that's the actual danger that they found themselves in. And that's the point from which Paul writes this entire book. Now, verse 5, and we'll end our study here tonight. They serve a copy and shadow of the heavenly things. For when Moses was about to erect the tent, he was instructed by God, saying, "See that you make everything according to the pattern that was shown you on the mountain." So the key concept that he adds here is the concept of pattern. And he's saying that the original establishes a pattern. The substance establishes a pattern. And while not mentioning them directly, remember, I've added them to our list of the progression of God's special meeting places throughout world history. But the Garden of Eden was simply a copy and shadow following that same pattern. The Ark of Noah was simply a copy and shadow following that heavenly pattern. The tabernacle and the temple were simply copies and shadows following that pattern. But the pattern is on full display in heaven. We don't know exactly what it will look like when we arrive in heaven, but we do know this in terms of of direct similarity between the tabernacle and the temple on earth, the earthly tent, and the heavenly tent or the heavenly temple that exists now in heaven and always has existed, is that there was a seat in the tabernacle, there was a seat in the temple, and that seat was represented symbolically by this special box that we've studied about many times, the Ark of the Covenant. But the high priest was never allowed to sit there. But there is a parallel connected to that Ark of the Covenant that exists in heaven, always has existed, exists now, and always will exist. What is that connection? The connection is that is the throne of God, and that throne establishes the pattern for the Ark of the Covenant to follow. And the one, of course, seated on the throne is the heavenly high priest, who is himself the original and the substance of what the high priestly ministry was always meant to convey. So it's a heavenly pattern, and it is the point. And I'm here going back to verse 1 where he starts this section. Now the point in what we are saying is this. The point of all of this stuff that God has done through history is to open progressively the eyes of his people to understand the great fulfillment in Christ and in heaven, and that all of these things that the people of God have attached their heart and their hopes to now need to be redirected to the heavenly structure and to the one who serves in that heavenly structure. Their only hope is there in heaven, and their only hope is the one who functions as that heavenly, seated in glory high priest.